From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On today's show, the wide world of sports.
And he dives! And he's got it! He's got it! And the Bananas are CPL champions!
We'll find out why the Savannah Bananas have such passionate fans. Also, the break room panel talks about a controversial finish line dive that won a former UGA sprinter a gold medal. That's coming up. First, yesterday we talked to the director of a new documentary about the black athletes who risked their lives to compete in the 1936 Berlin Olympics. We asked about your favorite documentaries, and here are your first thoughts. Stephen Barrett chooses Gimme Shelter. That's a film about the Rolling Stones' 1969 tour. He says it works as a concert film, journalism, and dramatic nonfiction. It's a masterpiece. Carlene Watson picks another entertainment film, 20 Feet from Stardom. And Edward Austin Hall says, that's easy, When We Were Kings. That's the documentary about the Muhammad Ali, George Foreman rumble in the jungle. We always love to get your thoughts and your recommendations. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter, it's at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. For the last several years, Issa Rae has been on a mission to prove there's not one way to be a black woman in comedy. You may have seen her web series, The Misadventures of an Awkward Black Girl. It premiered in 2011.
Let me introduce myself. My name is Jay, and I'm awkward and black. Someone once told me those were the two worst things anyone could be.
So now, 5 years on, Rae's latest project is an HBO series called Insecure.
Hey, Poppy. Where you going?
It's too aggressive.
I just want to be confident, brave me. I want to be that person. Let's have fun tonight.
I'm Jared.
Issa.
Issa is in Atlanta tonight for a screening of Insecure about a month before it premieres on HBO. The showing is part of the Bronze Lens Film Festival, and she joins me now. Issa, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Now, you chose to keep your real name in this HBO series. How come?
You know what? If I could go back, I wouldn't, because it got really confusing, like doing post-production, doing getting notes and things like that. But I just wanted to show that this was kind of a show about me and my life, not necessarily a biography, but this character was true to my essence.
But how concerned are you that fans are going to see this as a biography and going to ask you about things that happened in the show as though they happened to you?
Very concerned, because they did the same for Awkward Black Girl, and that wasn't even my name. So I just don't put it past anyone.
How do you handle that, then, if they did that when you were doing the web series as well?
I mean, I just tell them that it's not true, you know, but I wish you had asked me these questions when I first started pitching it, because I definitely didn't think ahead.
Okay. So I saw this one video that you'd posted in which you were giving advice to your younger self. I think it was called Hashtag Dear Me. And the main thing you wanted to tell your younger self was to not be concerned about whether you were black enough. Is that part of the theme of this new series as well, insecurity over what kind of black you are?
In a very subtle way. I think there's just the preconceived notions of blackness that we want to override with this series, and I think with this character. And she, in the very opening episode, talks about how her best friend is loved by white people and black people alike, and she isn't. And I think that she may confuse that with perceptions of blackness that she doesn't fit, but she'll soon find that it's a bit more than that. But that's just something that I've always explored in my themes, in all of my work, just the different types of black people, and the fact that we're not a monolith, and that we have varied experiences that inform and shape us, and the character's journey to security or to confidence will lie in challenging that and asking those questions.
I mean, honestly, the opening few minutes of it have to be one of the funniest opening few minutes of any pilot ever. I mean, this is a group of, for those, I don't think I'm giving any spoilers. It's a classroom full of kids who are asking you really inappropriate questions. And one of them is like, why do you talk like a white girl?
Right.
How many of those questions have you actually gotten from a kid or otherwise?
I've got all those questions in real life.
But not from kids. I don't want to say all of them.
But all of those questions have been asked to me at some point in life, either when I was a kid or by kids at some point. Yes, I can honestly say that.
They asked you what was up with your hair.
Oh, my God. Come on. Yes.
Have you gotten better at fielding those kind of things, or do people just not ask you that stuff anymore?
You definitely get asked some things, you know, but I don't get asked why I talk like a white girl at all anymore. But I mean, I think that's just more of growing up and people realizing that, okay, speaking proper English is not equated with speaking white, you know. And some of the other questions have just been, you know, I use any question that's offensive, I will turn and flip back. Like, you use humor as a defense mechanism. So that's something that I've grown to do. I will jab back and clap back quickly.
I don't want to make it seem like this show is about being black, because it seems to just be about more, at least I've seen one episode. I saw the pilot, and that one seemed to have been more about friendship and how to be a good friend. And so how do you balance those things? And I ask that because there's so few African-American or people of color anchoring sitcoms on either on mainstream TV or on cable at all. So to a certain extent, you're a representative. And I wonder how you balance that with just wanting to put together a good storyline about human beings.
One, we wanted to just tell a story about regular people that happen to be black. And that was first and foremost. Like, we didn't want to hit you over the head with the fact that, oh my God, we're black and all black issues, because that's not how black people talk. That's not how people of color talk. Like, we just wanted to create something real at the end of the day and portray something real. And so, you know, situations arise from being a person of color, and, you know, we wanted to talk about those and feature those incidents, those experiences, and again, didn't want to be didactic and be like, here's a lesson to learn from them. Just be like, okay, this is just a part of what we deal with in our day-to-day lives, in a very slice-of-life show, and made sure that that was the core of our storytelling. And it helps when you have a writer's room that's diverse. You have, you know, people with varied experiences who are also contributing things from their own personal lives, so it doesn't feel like we're just making stuff up at the end of the day to teach a lesson.
So one of your writing partners is, of course, Larry Wilmore, and his program, The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, was just canceled last week. Let's hear a little bit of it.
But I am Larry Wilmore, your next host for the next, 29 minutes and 31 seconds. Now, let me just say, it's never easy when your television show gets canceled. But I have to tell you, for me, there has been a silver lining, you guys. All the free booze.
So, what worked against Larry, do you think? And I ask that because there seems to be a difficulty in the United States, at least, for us, for an African-American to find success hosting a talk show. And except for Oprah, she's the one outlier to a certain extent.
That's so sad.
but we have no problem with African-Americans. With Beyonce, I mean, there are some arenas in sports or in music where their sky is the limit, and in some areas where it isn't. Why?
We always joke about the fact that there's, like, one slot for us. Like, we're always fighting on one slot, and if you hire, like, one black person, now you can't have another black person on, you know? Like, that's it. And, you know, I think that the Comedy Central prides itself on The Daily Show, and I do think that in hiring, you know, another black person to fill the spot.
Trevor Noah.
Yes, Trevor Noah. Simple Americans and simple viewers and possibly simple executives were like, well, people aren't watching both. People don't want to watch both. So instead of pairing them together and having them work with one another to show how different they are and how different their voices are, they sort of played into the fact that it had to be one or the other, which really sucks. And it's their loss at the end of the day. But Larry will be just fine.
Okay, so last year we spoke with another comedian, George Wallace. He was born and raised here in Atlanta, and he's been doing stand-up for 4 decades or so. I asked him a question about how comedy has changed over the past 40 years, and here was his answer.
It's still basically the same. We just discuss it differently. People express themselves differently. When I was a kid starting comedy, the young kids, we didn't use swear words, curse words. Now the young kids in rapping, they express themselves differently. So, and it's much harder to be clean and funny than it is to be every other word. I have nothing against blue comedians, because funny is funny. Let's make that perfectly clear.
I wonder how easy the transition is between doing a web series where you basically have a lot of freedom, and then you're at HBO where you also have a lot of freedom. Would you have been able to reproduce this on, say, NBC?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, maybe that's one of the big advantages of doing a show on cable and on HBO specifically, which is, you know, very writer friendly and very voice friendly. I think that, yeah, I've always maintained that if I ever took a show to television, I wanted to be on HBO specifically for those very reasons. I don't think that I would have been able to tell the same story on any network.
Do you have censors? Do you have to get your plot lines and your writing through a board or somebody who's editing?
We deal with basically two development executives who are very, very smart. And as a team, you know, Prentice, our showrunner, we just navigate their notes, and they really help to make it better. But it's very small, which helps. And you're not going through a studio and for notes and then a network for notes and then, you know, dealing with advertisers and things like that. It really is streamlined with just two people, which is so refreshing.
So do you have like a list in your head of stereotypes you kind of want to address? I mean, do you think, okay, here's one thing people assume about Black people or Black women, and I want to make sure I get to this on my show. Do you have that sort of list somewhere in your subconscious?
There are some experiences that I definitely want to touch on, but for the most part, I want to make sure that the character, that anything that happens stays true to the characters that we've presented thus far. But there are definitely stories that I want to tell and things that I want to discuss and have people discuss. Yeah, there's definitely a list in the back of my mind.
Okay, how about these two? And these come from comedian Dulcie Sloan, who's from Atlanta, just moved to L.A. She brought up two stereotypes she has had enough of.
The only time I've given this trope of the angry Black woman or the sassy Black woman or whatever is when white people say that. Black people, I'm just a Black person who talks. Like, I don't have to prove my Blackness to anybody because I'm Black all day. And if anyone questions my Blackness, they're usually white or a Black person I don't know. So, you know, I don't try to make excuses for my comedy. I don't try to explain it to anybody. If you get it, you get it. You don't, you don't.
Where are you on that spectrum of caring what people, what comments, either whites or Blacks say?
I'm exactly with her. She couldn't have put it better. And that even that is something that we address in a show, actually a few episodes in. So you'll definitely see that addressed and acknowledged. But I 100% agree with her. I don't care at this point. And that's something that I'm so proud of with this show, is that we're not like, they're inside jokes. There's a vernacular that we use. There's so many things that we don't feel the need to explain because we don't have to, you know, in the same way we make no apologies. It's very much like a bias for us, but everybody's welcome to watch type of show.
So to me, it feels surprising that I'm talking to you about this when you studied African-American studies at Stanford, but it may not be. Was this sort of a goal for you all along?
What? I would like to tell my dad that. It was very disappointed. That, like, hey, Dad, this was all the plan, you know? But no, I mean, you hope that, like, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to direct and produce, but I didn't think it would come to this. You know, you hope, but I never imagined.
Writer and actress Issa Rae, she's the creator and star of the upcoming HBO series Insecure. It screens tonight at 7 at the Georgia Pacific Auditorium in Atlanta. It's part of the Bronze Lens Film Festival. Her show also debuts on HBO on October 9th. And after the showing, there will be a discussion with her. Issa, thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Just ahead, The Break Room returns. We'll talk about a gold-winning dive and the end of public comments. But first, the Savannah Bananas had a breakout year. We'll talk to two of their biggest fans. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's been a tough season for baseball fans in Atlanta. The Braves have only won 46 out of 127 games. That makes them the worst team in Major League Baseball. But it's a different story for the Savannah Bananas. The amateur team debuted this year and won the Coastal Plains League Championship last week. The Bananas also broke the league's season attendance record with over 90,000 fans. Producer Taylor Gant spoke with two of the Bananas' number one fans, and they share their favorite moments from the past season.
I'll tell you, I went to every ball game. I watched the Bananas play. I still love my Atlanta Braves, but hey, I'm a banana fan for sure. My name is Greg Miller. I live here in Savannah. Been a fan of baseball my entire life, and I'm old enough to remember when Dale Murphy played for the Savannah Braves team. So I've watched a lot of baseball at Grayson Stadium over the years. And to see 4,000 people standing and cheering and to hear that stadium rocking.
And he dives! And he's got it! He's got it! And the Bananas are CPL champions!
I don't know that that's ever happened in that stadium at any point in time. And I remember looking around and going, you know, wow, what a moment in the history of Savannah baseball, the town that was defined as not being a baseball town, has suddenly become an awesome baseball town. And it's these crazy yellow uniforms with the banana running around. That's what brought it here. That was when it just kind of hit that this is a pretty big deal.
As Sharp, the PA announcer, Grayson says, the bases are full of bananas.
My name is Sally Yarber, and I live on Tybee Island. My husband and I had season tickets to the Savannah Bananas this year, and we absolutely love this season. When we had the other team here, they played twice as many games, and so they were gone a lot. There was no accessibility. We couldn't have any interaction with the boys. Now, where my husband and I sit is right behind the catcher, and so we can see them, we know them, we have clappers, so we're noisy and they know who we are. So when we would see them out in the community, they were always friendly. They would talk to you, you'd ask them where they were from. It was just a totally different kind of group of boys.
Let's go, Banana! Let's go, Banana!
They always had a thing called a home run hitter, and they would get a child generally who was really too young to play ball, and he would hit the ball off the tee. And then the players deliberately would overthrow or miss a ball or take too long, and the little child got to run from home plate to first, second, third, and back to home. But one night, they had a young man in a wheelchair, and he was being pushed by one of the players. And this fella got to hit the ball and make a home run. And then at the end, you get to keep the ball, and he walks through doing high fives with all of the players. It was just so moving for me as a mother and a grandmother. But anybody watching that had to have been moved. It was just wonderful.
Savannah Banana fans Sally Yarber and Greg Miller. The Bananas won the Coastal Plains League Championship last week. It has been a long week. We talked about tasers in elementary schools, craft beer, and the challenges women face behind bars. So as we do every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Oh, my goodness me! Phoenix thinks she's done it, and Shawnee Miller has collapsed across the line.
I need a vacation.
It's collard greens.
That doesn't really make sense, because you don't call them collared people. That's offensive.
Joining us in the break room, Kalina Poehler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast, Robbie Medwed, an Atlanta-based LGBT educator and activist, Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and Greg Williams is host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Yay, good morning.
Hi.
Since it's Friday and we're just about at the finish line, let's talk first about finish lines. Former UGA runner Shawnee Miller won a gold medal in the Olympics for the Bahamas. She dove at the last second at the finish line in the women's 400-meter race. Miller's dive put her ahead of Felix by 0.07 seconds. And in an interview with CCTV after the race, Miller was totally unapologetic.
Sometimes you just can't control it, and you know it's a part of the sport. So you know, I don't really let things get to me. So I saw it and I was just like, ah, it's whatever. But you know, I got my gold medal, so I'm happy right now.
All right. Diving is allowed by track and field athletes. A runner officially crosses the finish line when his or her torso crosses, and a photo of the finish revealed that Miller's torso was slightly in front of Felix's as she dove. But it has raised a controversy of people wondering, should this be allowed? What do we think?
Should it be allowed? I don't think so, because you're running and you're on feet, and that's the point. However, if it is allowed, then absolutely use it. You're in the Olympics. This is the one time to get a gold medal, so if the rules are there, they're not breaking any rules. Morally, okay, maybe it's not so great, but, you know, I'm going to use every advantage that I have that's legal to me to get the gold medal if I'm in that place.
Okay, maybe not the spirit of the law, but the letter? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I as a UGA grad, I was quite happy to see UGA come out ahead on that one. But, you know, she ran for 99.9% of the race. So I think that diving across the finish line is certainly acceptable. And, you know, this race only happens once every 4 years. So and the good news about the internet is everybody became experts in track and field rules after the controversy. I mean, I know a lot about how torso comes first. So.
Right. And then every runner, as they reach the finish line, they're all leaning forward in some way. So in a way, they're all diving in a way. They may not be absolutely horizontal like she was, but, you know, I don't think it's a problem.
Yeah. And where do you draw the line between a trip or a lean, a dive? How can you tell? Let's just make a rule and stick with whatever the rule is and not make a fuss about.
I'm just amazed that she can dive and not tear up all of her skin. Mm-hmm. I mean, I walk down the street and fall down and I'm bleeding everywhere. How can you dive across a track like
These are
that?
Professionals.
Exactly. I'm just not a professional faller, I guess.
And some of the furor was basically, if Allyson Felix had done it and the USA had won, the narrative would have been, look, she sacrificed everything for gold. But because it was a Bahamian, was that how you say it?
You're asking the wrong question.
You don't have any Bahamas in you, have everything else.
Yeah, so almost everything else. All right, let's move on to a considerably more serious controversy. Actor and director Nate Parker. An alleged rape from 1999 has resurfaced. It happened while he was a student at Penn State. Parker and roommate Jean Celestine were accused of assaulting an unconscious female student. That female student tragically later committed suicide. Mm. Variety reporter Brent Lang told NPR's Audie Cornish Parker went on trial and was eventually acquitted.
Part of the reason that the jury found him to be not guilty seems to be the fact that he had had a consensual sexual encounter with the female the day before the alleged rape took place.
So this news breaks as Parker's film, The Birth of a Nation, is going to be released, already generating Oscar buzz. Celestine is Parker's co-writer on the movie. But, okay, here's the question. Let's say at this point you now have doubts about his character. But can you separate and should you separate the art from the artist?
I have a really hard time separating it out. I really want to. I know that I could, and maybe even sometimes possibly should, but there's so many times that I just can't split the two. I see musicians and all these things, and I know that whatever money I'm spending on their stuff is going to go to them, and they're not going to face the consequences. And maybe not my dollar getting to them isn't going to be such of a consequence, but I just have a really hard time not separating them out.
Mm. Well, I'm a little. I'm on the edge with this because I know how important the subject of this film is going to be, and I know that this is truly going to be a work of art from all accounts. I did not feel the same way when, you know, we put R. Kelly on trial. I don't think, you know, the remix to Ignition is any sort of art. That said, you know, I honestly am really, really, really upset about this whole thing because I wanted to go into the film, you know, wholeheartedly, and I feel like I can't. I feel like I'm almost been let down by the artist, and I feel like the artist
first time it's
now.
Come up. It's not just R. Kelly. We've got Roman Polanski, at which there's questions.
Woody Allen. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right. Almost any New York director, really, right?
But does it affect his credibility in producing, as Kalina has said, an important topic that he's covering? We have to be able to trust what he's producing on an important topic, and that's where we have to determine whether or not this impacts his credibility.
Well, and I've always been able to kind of separate the two. You know, anytime most of the actors and musicians, they tend to lean to the left. So, you know, if we get into this little game of trying to, well, I don't believe in his politics, so I'm just not going to listen to him. We'd never be able to go to movies as conservatives. So,
yeah, but there's
I
a
mean,
big difference between someone's politics and then a rape. Or with like Wagner, who, you know, notorious composer, but huge anti-Semitic for the Nazis. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
That's not the same as, oh, this person spoke out for this candidate. I don't really like that candidate either, mm-hmm. right? That's it. There's
well,
a big difference there.
Unfortunately, people are actually, they're becoming intertwined from what I'm seeing. So, yeah, I mean, if somebody is a convicted child molester, but they paint really good, I mean, what, you know, how do you you know, balance those two,
yeah,
right?
There you go. There's a lot of painters with troubled lives. We would love to get your opinions on this. Can you separate the art from the artist? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join us on Facebook. We got a tweet from Sansara Taylor who says, the birth of a nation can contribute to liberation. Re-prosecuting Nate Parker does not. So send us your comments as well. We're in the break room with Sam Burnham of All the Biscuits in Georgia, Robbie Medved, Kalina Bowler, and Greg Williams. Since we're making comments on internet stories, that leads me to NPR. National Public Radio will no longer allow public comments at its website.
No, look at the comments section. The comments are already rubbish.
There's five separate threads debating what constitutes rape, and someone with an anime avatar just said the N-word.
Yeah, that's why you don't read the comments.
Just stop reading the comments. It's a cabaret of crazies all vying for your attention.
So NPR joins Reuters, The Guardian, The Daily Beast, lots and lots of media companies in ending comments. The managing editor of digital news at NPR says the comment section was not providing a useful experience for the vast majority of our users. And numbers back that up. Less than 1% of NPR's audience actually commented on a story last month, for example. So how do we feel about this?
Let's get rid of it. Bye.
You're okay with it.
I'm totally fine with it.
Well, I'm happy with you know, any media or organization making their own choice. If they do think that the comments section is adding valuable discussion points, then leave it up there. I think that, I mean, in this room, everybody pretty much likes Twitter, and Twitter's where the mean people really do live. And the comments section can also serve as a spam. There's viruses out there. So I think that if you're going to have a comments section, you should make people really register with their real name and verify that it's a human and not somebody that has 37 little avatars up and they, you know.
No anonymous
comments.
Yeah,
absolutely. No. You got to stand by what you're saying. I have no problem getting rid of the comment section. I think there are plenty of ways people can make themselves heard these days. But if we are going to have the comment section, I want people to stand by what they say.
Yeah, I want it to be I want you to have your name on there and a picture of you, and that way we know that it's a literal person and not somebody that's just spewing hate speech or trying to push an agenda on their own.
But at the same time, a news organization, they're just trying to, you know, like NPR, and you know, they're trying to get journalism out there. Mm-hmm. And I feel that a comment section with a news organization is probably going to take away from some of the, you know, just being able to share a story. Here's what's going on. X, Y, Z. And we're done. Next. Let's move on. If it's a blog, you know, and you want more
like
interaction.
It's editorial, right?
Right, yeah. Right. I don't think, you know, NPR needs a comment section.
A news story, when I get to the comment section, I know I'm done scrolling. It's time to go elsewhere.
Do you have do you allow public comments at your blog?
I have moderated comments. And again, I don't get many comments, but at the same time, where do you draw that line? What is acceptable in your comment section as a blogger? And when are you stifling conversation? So maybe it's better to not have a comment section.
I think it becomes also more complicated for news organizations because people post incorrect things in the comment section.
That's true.
And then are we then obliged to go in there and correct the factual error?
Right. Well, once you start responding to the comments, then you're lost. But I think we also have to remember that not everybody's opinion really needs to be heard. I really am a firm believer that not every opinion in the world deserves a microphone. And I think especially if the only place that you can get your opinion across is in the comments, that's a big sign. Otherwise, then if your opinion really is that good, it's going to find its way out into all of these other mainstream places, and you're not going to be the only person with that comment.
You may even be a panelist on The Break Room sometime if your opinion is that good.
Exactly. And you comment enough, you're going to show up.
Clearly, nobody here ever posts in the comments section because we wouldn't have made the cut to be on the show today.
Or you know, some of us just, you know, we tweet a lot. Yeah. So that in hopes that it gets us here. But.
Okay. All right. You heard Robbie Medved. Not every opinion needs to be heard. You can respond to that by leaving us a message at 404-500-9457 or just complaints at robbiemedved.com. Oh, my goodness. It's Friday.
On my website.
We're at the break room. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, millennials have a problem taking a break from work, and they don't want anyone else to take a break either. That's next from On Second Thought, so stay with us. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We are hanging out in the break room with coffee and conversation, as we do every Friday. My guest today, Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Robbie Medved is an Atlanta-based LGBT educator and activist, and Kalina Bowler co-hosts the Real Snobs podcast. A thank you again to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that fuels our break room guests, and they are online at savannahcoffee.com, and they're the reason why we don't have the bad coffee that you find at so many public radio station. So we're about to get a weekend, but you know, it is nice when you can take a real vacation ride and come back refreshed to your job. But we have a new report from Project Time Off and GSK. They say the youngest employees in your office are the most likely to be work martyrs. Not only do they not take vacation days, but they shame other people who do take them.
Shame. 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 Shame.
Okay, so surveys show, actually, this is an American problem in a wider sense. Most Americans do not use up all of their vacation days. But why millennials? Why are they so prone to not only stay at work, but why do they have a problem with other people taking a break? And I'm looking at you, Kalina Bowler.
Yeah, because, okay, I'm staring off in the distance trying to think about this. I think this is a younger millennial generation issue because I'm on the older side and I'm trying to get a vacation like right now. And I just went back to work. You know what I mean? That said, I wonder if it is just a symptom of being young, going through, you know, the economic collapse we just went through and how much, you know, and how afraid everyone is of not being able to make money and save money and that sort of thing. I think a lot of younger people that are just getting into the workforce are realizing, oh, crap, I'm not going to have, you know, it, you know, the same opportunities my parents had when they were, you know, my age. Therefore, let me just go up and work and things of that nature.
Yeah, they realize their degree in ancient Sumerian poetry isn't going to land them the six-figure job, right?
Well, oh, come on now.
Well, what kind of latte would you like with that, sir?
But a lot of folks aren't making enough money to even bother with a vacation. So I'm going to stay home and may as well. Okay, I'll check the email. Oh, you know, and I'll just go on in. That kind of thing. I don't, you know, I've had to save up a lot of money to go on any vacations that I've wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot harder for other folks to think about that. I compare myself to a lot of my friends or younger friends who their apartments are really, really nice and they've got a lot of really nice stuff and that's where they're spending their money. And my apartment's not so nice so that I can go on vacations.
Mm. And it may be a response because we have this stereotype.
But we're not getting to the second half of why they're shaming other people.
Well, but I think there's probably this stereotype on the millennials that, you know, we say they're lazy.
Entitled.
They're entitled. They're this. They're that. And their response is, look, I'm working. I'm here. I'm not taking time off. Where are you going? You're the one telling me I'm lazy and you're laying on the beach. And I'm here, you know, busting my head against the wall working.
And it's also this generation, too, where millennials have grown up being tethered literally to their smartphones, where you never really can escape from work if you don't want to. And they're also used to prying into other people's lives with, you know, by following people on social media, Facebook comments and everything. So maybe that they're basically a generation of busybodies.
But also the easiest way to make yourself look better is to put someone else down. It's a lot harder to make yourself look good by just making yourself look good.
So Dan Trainer tweets, why millennials, huge debt, few jobs, low wages, and just last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, the break room shamed lazy kids. I remember that one.
Ooh, Guilty.
I'll believe you if we he did. Calling you guys out. Speaking of shame. All right. So since we're talking about young people and school especially, a high school in Little Rock, Arkansas has gone viral because they want parents to stay away.
Principal Steve Strasley had this picture posted on the Catholic High School for Boys Facebook page last Wednesday, reading, "If you're dropping off your son's forgotten lunch, books, homework, equipment, etc., please turn around and exit the building. Your son will learn to problem solve."
It's simply to help boys avoid the default switch of calling mom and dad when things don't go right and to come bail them out.
All right. Is this too harsh?
No, I am all for this.
100%. Love the idea. I think it's fantastic.
Neither Kalina nor Robbie ever forgot their lunch at home.
That's a lesson you learned once.
I did, and I think I would have benefited from doing without it. And
well, your mom brought you your biscuits.
Oh, yes. Yes. So I probably should have sat there and watched somebody else eat their biscuits and then realized that the next day I'm going to remember to grab my lunch on the way out the door. And I think it's a Catholic school. It's a private school. If you don't like the policy, don't send your child to this school.
Now, that's an aspect that I can support. But I just think that removing the parent from the equation is kind of, it's a direction that we're headed right now in this country. And it's negative. My mom used to, you know, make my lunch every day.
That
says a lot.
Parents
are probably listening right now.
Yeah.
And so for, you know, that, and now basically all the schools, even the wealthy kids get free breakfast and free lunch now in certain areas. And that, I think, just removes a part of an interaction that parents can have in their lives. My mom would always put in an extra cookie or something like that uh-huh. made me realize that it was personalized. And I think, you know, when we remove that aspect of it and the parental involvement in their children's lives, you know, that's any type of higher education person will tell you the reason.
So you're saying the person who's supposed to be teaching them responsibility is the parents,
yes,
not necessarily the school.
And, you know, we always say parents aren't involved with their children's school lives, and that's part of the reason we've had a decline in education results
okay,
here. So
there's a difference between a parent showing up for a PTA meeting or some sort of community organization situation for their child and constantly coddling them and saying, oh, you know, my 12th grader left his lunch at home again. He forgot to do his homework again. He forgot to, you know, and they're leaving their jobs or leaving their homes and coming there and saying, it's okay, sweetie, this, that, and the other. I was in school in undergrad with so many people, and these are adults at this point that I consider them supposed to be adults, who flunked out of freshman year because they're so used to someone saying, get up at a certain time, this, that, and the other. By the time you're in 11th, 12th grade, you should not be, you know, forgetting the basics.
I am so proud of you guys. My left-wing friends are learning personal responsibility.
Come on now. So my
heart is warm now.
Oh, boy.
My parents were at everything, every performance, every game,
right,
all that stuff. But the second I had an issue with a teacher, that was my problem.
Okay.
They would never call the teacher for me, never took a test for me, never did any of that. It was like they will help me get everywhere I could go, get me to the door. But at a certain point, I had to walk through that door. And even though I made my lunch sometimes, my parents made my lunch sometimes, I still had that relationship with them. But we do ask our public institutions to finish the job, to teach us. We don't expect our parents to teach us languages and math and all that stuff. We ask the schools to do that. So it's not really cutting them out.
Yeah, I made my lunch for my kid, but if he forgot it, that was on him.
That's what I'm saying. You can make a lunch all day, but if they
You're going hungry, dude. I'm at work. You can give us your own opinion. We're at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us. We have so many tweets, I can't even read them, or find us on Facebook. We're in the break room with Robbie Medved, Kalina Baller, Sam Burnham, and Greg Williams. So let's move on to tiny houses. The tiny house movement, not just because of that show, but it's very popular. The idea is you live in very small homes. Some of them look like garden sheds. They're less expensive and they have less of an impact on the environment. But some people wonder if not everyone is as concerned about the environment as others. Some people are looking at places like the Butter Bar, which is a popular restaurant in San Francisco. It's a trailer park themed restaurant that prides itself on serving trashy food and drinks. And then you've got fashion, which is intentionally torn and distressed. And you have other restaurants as well that are kind of leading to this poverty chic. And some people who are poor are saying, wait a second, is this appropriating poor culture by people who are wealthy and don't have to live that way? Okay, Greg's already laughing. What do you think, Greg?
Yeah, appropriating poor culture. I guess I hadn't been to the Smithsonian exhibit to see what poor culture is. But yeah, I don't know. That's just bizarre to me. So,
Sam?
This cultural appropriation thing, I don't know where it stops, where it begins. How do you know if you're stepping on somebody's toes? How do you know if you're minding your own business? How do you know if you're, am I in my own culture doing this, or am I experiencing someone else's, or am I getting Americanized Chinese food? Am I appropriating that? I mean, where does it start
you,
and end?
You are not appropriating Chinese culture if you eat Chinese food.
Fortune cookies are not actually Chinese, by the way.
Yeah,
I would say there's a big difference also between appropriating culture and just not having good fashion sense or good taste. You know, we talk like people used to pay hundreds of dollars for ripped jeans when a scissor and it's a little patience can get the same thing. It's just some people really, they have to have the brand name that goes along with it. It's obnoxious. It's you know, boring and all that kind of stuff. And I do remember back when tiny houses were just called trailer parks. And that's great.
You can make your own jean shorts if it's scissors, actually.
How many pairs of jean shorts do you have?
Zero. I went to Georgia, not Florida.
Fair enough.
I want zero pictures of any of you in jean shorts. Kalina, you want to weigh in here?
I don't know how to feel about this one. I will say this. When the tiny house movement started, you know, really picking up steam, I said to myself, okay, I get the economical thing about it. I get that, you know, people are trying to downsize. Mortgages really screwed people over, this, that. But I don't know if this is something where people are saying, oh, you know, that homeless guy over there and his tent over there, that there's something about what he's doing. You know what I mean? I think this may be a bit of a stretch, and yet there are going to be people out there that are going to try to, you know, make this a pop culture thing.
It's already a pop culture thing.
Yeah, definitely.
It's on HGTV. There's TV
have y'all
shows
seen,
about it.
Didn't
Decatur
y'all
just have a tiny house?
Y'all have been to IKEA, right? So they have all the designs for, like, here's what you can do with 300 square feet or anybody that's been
dorm
to
room.
I think that's cool.
It's helpful.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay. So let's move on to something where I think we might get more differing opinions. Good Morning America host Amy Robach got in hot water this week. She used the phrase colored people when they were having a discussion about diversity in Hollywood.
Hollywood has received recent and quite a bit of criticism for casting white actors in what one might assume should be a role reserved for colored people.
Now, Robach is getting a lot of criticism, but I will say that she almost immediately acknowledged that it was a mistake and inappropriate and apologized and said she meant to say people of color. So my question is, how does one make a mistake without getting reamed out now?
I'm not sure we can make a mistake without getting reamed out. I think the best we can do is apologize as quick as we can.
Which she
and
did.
And then move on. And there are going to be people who are upset at everything. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the comment sections anymore to let out that frustration. So they're going to find other ways to do it. But she really did. I mean, it's a really common mistake to say, you know, you mean to say people of color and you flip the words because you're talking and there's TV cameras and all those things. She apologized. She moved on.
Yeah. She didn't sound like the type that typically uses racial slurs.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know a whole lot about her biography, but she, you know, clearly that was a little bit of a tongue twister for her. And, you know, we have a situation now where we're always walking on eggshells around people. Did I say the wrong thing? I don't really care about walking on eggshells, as we've found out on the show.
That's
before,
very
but,
true.
A lot of other people do.
Kalina, you're our person of color.
Yes, I'm the person of color and woman in the room today. Listen, I don't feel that the term colored person is so much a racial slur as it is antiquated, an antiquated term that, you know, people tend to use. But the fact that she said, oh, I meant to say person of color, but it came out to be colored person. I would never say colored personally. I would never say a colored person when referring to someone who is of color. I don't know how often she or people in her circle use that term. So maybe for her, it may have been something off the top of her head. That said, I don't believe this was this has anything to do with a racist intention or anything like that. She probably just in her circles uses that term maybe. And it was easier for her to come up with on the fly as, you know, as a journalist trying to, you know, get the words out there. You
live
know what
radio
I mean?
Is hard.
It's hard.
Yeah. All right. We have like 2.5 minutes left and let's see if we can get through this one in that period of time. Bill Nye, the science guy, got into a debate about the devastating floods in Louisiana. He said they're caused by global warming. On CNN, Nye called out meteorologist Chad Myers. He did not use his name, who's been in the past has rejected the concept of climate change.
Here at CNN, you have essentially a climate change denier meteorologist, and knock yourselves out. But this is a big problem, and it's not going to go away.
Okay, so here's the question. A meteorologist is technically a scientist. Is it okay? Everyone has different points of view. Should they get equal time?
Well, with climate change, here's the debate on it. Is it man-made climate change? I think everybody can agree the climate has changed on the 4 billion years that the Earth has been around. Climate has changed many, many times. We've gone through many iterations of hot and dry spells. So
that's not really a debate among scientists, though. I mean, that's settled among scientists.
But whether it's man-made or not.
Right. Even that is not really a debate. I want to be clear on the science.
You know, well, me and Sam may still want to debate that point now.
Right.
Among scientists, it's not a debate.
But look at this scenario here. Okay, we have floods in Louisiana. Oh, this is climate change. You have a snowstorm up north, and we say, see, look, it's not getting warmer. It's getting colder. And we're told, oh, well, you know, this is weather. This is not climate.
There's more Antarctic ice right now than in the past 50 years. So.
We only have like about 30 seconds left, but the question is not whether you guys would debate it, but whether we should have a scientist
I'm going to go back to, a meteorologist is a scientist, but there are plenty of other meteorologists who are there for fame. I have no problem with a network or somebody saying, we've got brand standards, we've got agency standards, this is our position, and this is how we do things, because there is enough science to back it up. But we see it also in political reporting. We see it in other areas where we really believe that every side deserves something equal, and not every side really all the time is actually an equal conversation.
Oh, yeah, he
almost did it again.
I did, absolutely.
And on that note, we are out of time in the break room. I want to say thank you to everybody. Colleen Balder, co-host The Real Snobs podcast. Robbie Medwed, LGBT educator and activist. Sam Burnham curates All the Biscuits in Georgia blog. And Greg Williams hosts the radio show Greg's List. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
As always, that is our show for today. But we would love to hear from you. You can talk back to us on anything that you just heard, but especially on this issue of whether or not you have a problem with a journalist organization, say, hiring and employing a climate denier. Does it matter? You can tweet us at OST Talk or post to Facebook, as always, for today and the week that is on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.
She stood there bright as the sun on that California coast. He was a Midwestern boy on his own.